age say, the end, the end, the end. November the 9th, 1936, Mary Fox, 85 East 65th Street, Apartment 11, New York City. Mary, many thanks for your letter of November the 1st. Here is what I propose, to have my secretary wait for you this Saturday at 1 p.m. in order to collect the pages you want me to look at and to buy you a consolatory lunch if you're hungry. Sal Mugundy on Lexington and 61st is a personal favorite of mine. If you object to the time, place, date, or all three, then please say so by return. Otherwise, save your stationery. Yours most chastened, the abominable, contemptible, vile, execrable, etc., Mr. Fox, 177 West 77th Street, Apartment 25, New York City. I telephoned Catherine at the Long Island house. Mitzi answered, and I told her that this was an impromptu French oral examination to keep Catherine's skills elastic. "Bonjour," Catherine said when she came to the phone. She was slightly out of breath, all that tennis. "Comment ça va?" "Got a letter from Mr. Fox," I said. She laughed, and I heard her clap her hands. "What did he say? Did he suck it to you?" She stopped laughing as she soaked up the realization that I couldn't speak. I was in too much of a state. Once I'd recovered, I asked, "Why did you send it, Catherine?" "I just thought it would be fun." As she spoke, I pictured her standing before me, eyeing me with all the defiance of Lucifer. In a smaller, meeker voice, she said, "Stop hating me. Who is he, anyway?" "Just a man," I said. In my mind, I was already reorganizing the contents of the black folder. I'd kept working on the stories, and they were stronger now and better. I was sure of it. It was just as well he hadn't met me at the Mercier. On Saturday afternoon, I stood paralyzed on the pavement outside the restaurant, which had these smart black and silver revolving doors. Every time someone stepped into them, I knew I was meant to take the next empty space and push myself into the lobby. But when I finally did, I found that I couldn't stop pushing at the door until I'd spun back out into the street again. I tried to be firm with myself, but with each glimpse of the restaurant full of marble and women genteelly eating salad, I lost my nerve to join them and ran inside the doors like a rodent in a glass maze. On the corner, a man in a suit was standing beside an apple cart. "Apples," he said. "Get your apples." No one was buying, so he began juggling them. "Look what I've sunk to," he sang. "God, I hate these apples. I'd rather starve to death than eat these apples. Tra-la-la." He was a tenor. Finally, he started telling the people passing that he had kids at home. Someone suggested he feed the apples to his kids. He caught my eye. "You're my witness. When you're out of work, people think they can talk to you anyhow." I nodded and went back in for another bout with the revolving doors. By now, people trying to enter the restaurant from the street were asking me if I was crazy or what. The fifth time, I saw the maitre d' frowning menacingly, and the sixth time, a woman came to meet me out on the street. She seized my arm as if I was a naughty child about to scamper off somewhere. "That's enough of that," she said. "You'll tire yourself out." I coughed out an "ouch, do you mind?" and hoped the apple seller wasn't looking. The woman's grip was surprisingly strong. She wore a brown skirt suit and a tiny brown hat tipped coquettishly over one eye. "Let go of me," I said. When she didn't, I pleaded, "I'm meeting someone." "Who?" she asked. "I don't see how that's any of your business." She shook me a little. "Mr. Fox's secretary," I said. "I'm meeting Mr. Fox's secretary."
"Then it's just as well, isn't it, that I'm her?"
She released me at last, and we stood nose to nose. I glared, and she just looked back with an air of melancholy. "You'd better prove it," I said. For some reason, I'd thought the secretary would be a man.
"You're Mary Fox?" she said, looking me over.
"I'm Mary Fox," I said. The woman produced an envelope from her handbag, pulled my letter out of it, and showed me.
"Abominable Mr. Fox," I read,
then winced and returned it to her, apologizing. She said,
Don't apologize. I think it's funny. But she didn't laugh or even smile. What's your name? I asked. Doesn't matter, she said. I handed her the black folder full of stories, and I asked her what Mr. Fox was like. The secretary blinked slowly, thinking. He's kind of quiet, she said. She wandered away with the folder sticking out of her handbag, leaving me alone on the sidewalk. I watched her, thinking she might suddenly remember something and turn around. Once I was sure that she'd gone, I hailed a cab. A week went by. He didn't write to me. He had my folder and he didn't write to me. Then three more silent weeks. Six. Eight. My fingernails crept down into their beds. My eyes grew glassy. I brushed my hair with my back to the mirror. I had no interest in looking at myself. It was the sensation of teeth against my scalp that subdued me. It was all I could do not to write to him again. You should go get your stories back, Catherine said when I briefly explained the situation to her. He's probably going to steal them or something. How would you know they're good enough for him to want to steal them? Oh, I know, Catherine said sagely. I read them, all of them. I especially like the one about the disappearing zoo. That's the best one. I grabbed her before she could escape and unexpectedly found myself hugging her. I liked the fluffy weight of her head against my chest. She was just as surprised as I was. I neutralized it by calling her a bloody nosy Parker. Maybe that goddamn secretary stole the stories, Catherine suggested. I told you not to say that word. Which? Secretary? Stories? Maybe? Maybe, maybe, maybe. One morning, Mitzi said I ought to take a break. That was alarming. I stopped buttering my toast and said, Why, I'm fine. Thanks all the same, Mrs. Cole, but the weekends are enough for me. I made a swift analysis of my behaviour of the past 2 weeks or so. I'd not said or done anything particularly strange. I'd behaved more or less as I always did. Mitzi rose from her seat and cupped my face in her flower-scented hands. I was so nervous I could have bitten her. Honey, no one's saying you're not doing a good job. You're doing a wonderful job, isn't she, Katie? Catherine said yes and stuck her tongue out at me. It's just that you can't give your weekends to a soup kitchen and your weekdays to this little fiend of mine and just go on and on without stopping. What if you burn out or something? Honey, I'm telling you, I'd never forgive myself. She had a new bracelet on, stacked with emeralds brighter than her eyes. I hate rich people. Your face is all pinched, Catherine told me helpfully. So that morning, instead of taking Catherine to the Metropolitan Museum of Art, I went to get my stories back. 177 West 77th Street was easy to find. It was a posh apartment block, much like the Coles's, but smaller. More exclusive, I suppose. I entered the building behind a grocery delivery boy, who pulled a small township of brown paper bags along on a trolley behind him. The building directory indicated that Mr. Fox, at number 25, was on the fourth floor. As I waited by the lift, I caught sight of myself in the polished steel doors. I was grinning. On the fourth floor, I approached number 25 casually, as if I might not stop, as if I might well walk past it and continue on down the red-carpeted corridor. But I did stop at 25, and I rang the doorbell, and I knocked hard. The secretary answered the door. She wasn't wearing any lipstick or powder, and she'd yanked her hair up into a knot on the top of her head. She had a pencil behind each ear and one in her hand. She looked very, very young. "What can I do for you?" she asked. She didn't appear to recognize me. "My name's Mary Fox," I said. "Mary Fox," she said, as if repeating the name would help jog her memory. "I corresponded with Mr. Fox about some stories of mine. He said he'd read them, but I suppose he's too busy. I've come to take them off his hands.
She hesitated. Oh, God, she'd thrown my stories away. Or there was a mountain of manuscripts somewhere behind her, and she'd never find mine.
I met you outside Salmagundi on 61st and Lexington a couple of months ago, I said. There was a bit of a fuss with some revolving doors.
Her eyes lit up at last.
Oh, right, she said, right.
She looked over her shoulder, though no one had spoken.
Be right back.
She closed the door before I could peer into the flat. It seemed strange to me that Mr. Fox's secretary should be at his flat. I mean, secretaries belong in offices. 10 minutes later, she opened the door again and handed me my folder. I looked through it quickly. All the stories appeared to be there. The pages were well thumbed, and some parts were underlined.
He read them.
Suddenly I felt as if I could knock this woman down and charge into his study, pull up a chair and settle down to talk. As if she knew what I was thinking, she took a firmer stance in the doorway. She twirled her pencil between her slim fingers.
Yes, he did.
I didn't like the look in her eyes. My throat went dry.
And?
She shook her head.
You don't really want to write. What you want is love. Go find yourself a beau. You're so young, Miss Fox. Go have a little fun.
Did Mr. Fox say that? Or is this coming from you? She looked down.
It's coming from me, she told the floor. I want to talk to Mr. Fox, I said.
I stepped towards the secretary and she held her pencil out at eye level in an unmistakably threatening gesture. The point was very sharp.
What did Mr. Fox say? I said. Just tell me that and I'll go.
She didn't answer, and I said,
Are you Mr. Fox?
She laughed.
No. You are, aren't you? You're Mr. Fox.
I caught sight of a bare passageway, a telephone on a stand, the receiver off the hook. I heard no dial tone.
You're him.
She frowned.
I'm not. What did he say then?
Wait. The door closed again. When it opened, the secretary was holding a lit taper. The flame cast her eyes into shadow.
He said,
she paused and sighed,
he said I should do this.
She touched the taper to the black folder, and it caught fire. She blew the taper out before the flame struck her fingers, but I didn't let the folder go. The leather cover burned with a harsh sound like someone trying to hold back a cry between their teeth. Still, I held the folder. I felt the skin on my fingers shrink. I watched words turn amber and float away. I liked these stories. Catherine liked them. I'd worked hard on them. There was so much smoke in my eyes. But I held on.
Mary Fox had known that it was more than a matter of snapping her fingers and having Mr. Fox change his ways. She'd known it would be difficult, but this was beyond all her expectations. She'd been asleep for days in a four-poster bed in a dark blue room. There wasn't a part of her body that didn't ache. Her brain ached most of all. She'd felt terrible burning his stories, which she'd actually thought were rather good. She couldn't have let Mr. Fox get away with beheading her, though. That was exactly the kind of behaviour she'd set out to discourage. She was aware of a large clock ticking outside the bedroom door, but it didn't wake her up. Mary was busy having a very long dream. In her dream, she was a spinster, fastidious, polite, and 38 years old. Her features were plain and unremarkable. They'd always been plain and unremarkable. She'd been a dutiful daughter when her parents were alive, and now Dream Mary lived in the attic of the house her parents had left her. The remainder of the house she had hoped to let to a family, but no family liked the idea of living there with her up in the attic like that, so Mary let the house below to a solicitor named Pizarski. He was out all day, that was good. He was punctual with his rent, also good. In the evenings, however, he hosted parties that were exclusively attended by attractive young ladies who giggled for hours on end. That was tiresome. Mary and Mr. Pizarski kept their exchanges as brief as possible.
Morning, Miss F.
Good morning, Mr. Pisarsky.
Here is the rent, Miss F.
Thank you, Mr. Pisarsky.
Off home for Christmas now, Miss F.
Merry Christmas, Mr. Pisarsky. On Valentine's Day, Dream Mary bought herself a single red rose, then immediately ran back into the shop, confused and embarrassed, to return it. Most days, Dream Mary stayed at her desk until sunset, working in the special quiet of the otherwise empty house, the settling of floorboards and the ticking of clocks. She wrote romance novels under the pen name Wendy Darling. Hers were gloriously improbable tales, stuffed with happy coincidences, eternal devotion, and the unwavering recognition of inner beauty. They were in great demand, Mary's novels. They were read-them-once-and-throw-them-away sort of books, really. And Mary had seen people doing just that, throwing her novels away, or very deliberately leaving them behind on park benches and bus seats once they had finished. She tried not to let it get her down. She didn't like to brood. She kept a framed photograph of her parents on her desk to remind herself of their story, which amazed her. They had fallen in love and kept it up far into old age. That was all. Her father was the hero in every story she wrote, and her mother was the heroine. They'd been gone 5 years, but she brought them together again and again, 35 lines of cream-coloured foolscap folio at a time. And they never tired of finding each other, even when she was reduced in the final chapters to typing with just one finger, her little finger, jabbing out words until her hand curled up and could do no more. She completed a novel every other month and took August and December off. It was Dream Mary's custom to read the local newspaper as she ate her evening meal in the dining corner of her attic. She read it thoroughly, without omitting a single paragraph or page. It was much more difficult to be alarmed by the events of a day that was almost over. After that, she would go for a walk to keep fit. And upon her return to her attic, she would say a few phrases aloud, experimenting with a friendly tone of voice. She didn't often socialise, but it was important to keep her hand in. She rehearsed small talk about the weather and about children and the cost of living. From Mr. Pisarsky's party below, a gramophone puffed jazz up at her like smoke rings until she stopped drying. She put on her nightgown, did her stretching exercises, applied cold cream to her face, and went to bed. Her days were pleasant and her mood was even. One evening, Mary went for her after-dinner walk, as usual. She went through town, passing the tidy shop fronts, their signs beautifully lettered in glossy paint and print, striding over the mushy bank of sawdust outside the butcher's. The entire neighbourhood was at home. Wireless sets buzzed gently at her as she passed. Each house stood in its own square of garden, each garden with its own picket fence and its own garden gate. Not a curtain twitched. Mary climbed Murder Hill. It was a funny old hill. It started off as easily as walking on flat ground, and continued to seem flat even after she had begun to feel short of breath. She looked down at all the chimney tops and picked lavender. When she returned from her walk, she found the house suspiciously quiet. There was no rustling or giggling, no chiming of glassware to be heard anywhere in the house, she noticed. No party this evening. Mr. Pisarsky appeared, carrying a cake. It prickled with lit candles. At first glance, there appeared to be hundreds of them.
"Happy birthday, Miss Fox," he said, smiling warily.
He was right. It was her birthday. Dream Mary thought she might be sick. "Mr. Pisarsky," she said, "you shouldn't have." It was meant to sound light-hearted, but it didn't. He looked crestfallen.
"You don't like cake?"
"No, I do. How did you know it was my birthday?" In the kitchen, Mr. Pisarsky carefully dropped his burden onto the table. He stared at the candle flames. They both did. It seemed rude to look at each other just then.
"I gave my room a good spring cleaning last week," he said. "I found a birthday card, dated."
So he slept in her old room. She hadn't known that.
Hadn't checked to see whether or not he'd been keeping the lower half of the house in order, whether he had changed any aspect of the furnishing. The hallway and main stairs were tidy enough, and as long as the house didn't fall down, she didn't care. In the last few weeks of her mother's illness, they'd spent whole afternoons in that room. Afterwards, she'd moved out of that part of the house in a hurry, and she hadn't gone back for anything since, had waited in the parlour while prospective tenants looked the property over. She must have left a great many things in there.
"I've taken a liberty, haven't I?"
Mr. Pizarski gestured towards the birthday cake.
"Even as I bought it, I wasn't sure. You like to have secret birthdays?"
"You English, I am forever offending you."
"No, no."
Mary searched for her manners and caught hold of them again. "It's a lovely surprise." She pretended to make a wish and blew out the candles. Only 30 of them, she counted. Such flattery. She found 2 small plates and put a slice of the cake on each, then remained standing, holding her slice away from her. He stood too. He couldn't very well sit down and eat while she stood there, not eating. As they exchanged remarks, she was aware of treating him shabbily.
"I hope you didn't cancel a gathering on my account, Mr. Pizarski."
"No, I've been abandoned tonight."
Mr. Pizarski was unkempt for a man of the law. His hair wanted combing, and the elbows of his jacket could have done with a thorough darning.
"I'm sure they'll come back," Mary soothed.
"I hope she will. That is to say, to tell you the truth, Miss Fox, there is only one of them I particularly care for. The others are just her friends."
She hadn't taken a proper look at any of the girls that crowded the downstairs rooms most evenings. They all looked exactly the same to her.
"Well, best of luck, Mr. Pizarski. Is your name Russian?"
"I am a Pole, Miss F., though I have met Russians who bear the name. Have you ever been to my country?"
"Poland? No, I haven't been anywhere. Brighton, the Lake District and the Cotswolds a few times, London sometimes."
"A pity. Mine is a lovely country. In parts, simple and honest and strong. The landscapes, the buildings, the mead.
Oh, I must go there one day."
He smiled sadly with his mouth closed.
"One day. Not now. The rioting and more to come."
"Really?"
Her question was feeble, but he considered it with a quizzical twist of his mouth.
"Well, yes, of course. Really, you say? You don't think riots are so bad. Are you thinking of them as you do the weather here? A nuisance, but it's not so difficult to get on with things despite them?"
He described the 3 riots he had witnessed firsthand in 3 different cities. He made the anger of the poor and put upon sound like a storm on the ground. It scorched buildings when it woke. Its first touch killed.
"That is why I'm here," he finished. "Otherwise, pork pies and jellied eels be damned, give me my country."
Mary suspected her father would have especially liked this man.
"Are you... forgive me, I know nothing about solicitors, but is it quite usual to find solicitors like you, Mr. Pizarski?"
She had delighted him.
"Let me see. Perhaps not. I was a poet."
"Oh, a poet. But what's that?"
Wishy-washy, that was how she found most poetry. It just missed the point over and over again.
"What's that?" he agreed, laughing. "What's that?"
He took her plate from her hand.
"And now I will release you, even though you are unfair and have told me nothing in exchange."
She assured him that there was nothing to tell.
"Perhaps you could sing a song then," he suggested. "Or turn a cartwheel? Or you could laugh. Yes, laugh wonderfully, just as you are doing at the moment."
She left him with the cake and went up to her attic. She put on her nightgown, did her stretching exercises, applied cold cream to her face, and arranged herself on her bed with a stack of pillows supporting her head and neck. She looked up through her attic windows, up into the cloudy night. So Mr. Pizarski had been a poet. That was how he'd said it. I was a poet, as if the poet had died. He was in hiding, perhaps. He might have written something that someone powerful hadn't liked. There she lay, casting him as a character in one of her own romances. He didn't cut anything like a dashing figure, and he'd need to be 4 inches taller before he could even make an appearance in her prose. No more nonsense. At the count of three, I shall go straight to sleep, she informed herself. 1, 2, 3. Mary Fox woke up feeling refreshed and a little regretful. What if she were to abandon the task at hand? Mr. Fox was a hard nut to crack. It was good that he didn't know how Mary tried to take care of him, alphabetizing his reference books and checking and correcting his spelling and grammar while he lay asleep with his wife in his arms. If he knew how Mary loved him, he would turn it against her somehow. He would play with it, because that was what Mr. Fox did. He played. And there was something appealing about this Mr. Pizarski. Perhaps she could find him or someone like him out in the world. She imagined their courtship, quiet, restrained, but full of tenderness. She would learn more about Poland, and he would learn more about England, and they would clear up many funny little misunderstandings. They would pore over maps together. I was born here, I went to school here. They'd go to the seaside and sit on the pier under umbrellas in the rain. He would take her to the pictures and bring her violet creams. He would declare himself without words, bring her a daisy and retire with haste. And just thinking of how much he desired her but dared not presume, she would swoon over the tiny flower, dragging its petals across her lips and the backs of her hands, then shyly, languorously, along her inner thighs. And in time, and by being a good woman and a patient woman, she would have won a good and patient man. Mary turned onto her side. The pillow she was lying on was covered in spidery words, tiny but legible. She rubbed her nose against one of the words and smudged it. The words were carefully spaced so that the pale green of the pillowcase haloed them. What? Whole paragraphs? And they were numbered. 7, 8, 9. She turned again. Her head was surrounded with more writing. There was yet more under her hands. Long lines of words meandered all along the duvet, some running horizontal, some diagonal, some fitting into each other like puzzles, and numbered, all numbered. Laughing in an appalled sort of way, Mary Fox pulled the pillow out from under her head and read, 1. I may not be here when you wake up. If I am not here, read on. 2. Mary, Mary, quite contrary. I'm the easy option. You won't want me. 3. I have bought you more pillowcases and another duvet cover in case you cannot stand what I have done to these ones. I took them off the bed before I wrote on them, so there's no need to worry about the ink bleeding into the pillows, etc. 4. My English is probably better than yours. I deliberately muddle my grammar when I speak. It puts people at ease. They become friendly when I get things wrong. They speak slowly, use shorter words to help me. I hate it, but it's the best way to get on. You have never done this with me. Thank you. 5. I often sing Christmas carols in June, and I don't think it's bad luck. Do you? 6. It was on April 2nd last year that I discovered you had a dimple in your right cheek. You smiled at me for some reason. Why? I had done nothing to deserve it. Please explain if you remember April 2nd. On the calendar in my office I made a note. M.F. revealed dimple today. What do you think of sentimental men? I'm sure you hate them. And you'd be right, too. Mary sat bolt upright. Was Mr. Pizarski a dream or not? She studied her surroundings. She had no idea where she was. There was a vase full of foxgloves on her bedside table, their petals the pale, shocking blue of the veins in a wrist. She moved on to the next pillow. 7. I learned English when I went to war. People think I'm lying when I say that, but that's how it was. We were in Galicia, Poles in Russian uniforms trying to court independence. We only managed to occupy a slice of the place, while the Germans and the Austrians made off with the rest. We were fighting so very hard and achieving so very little aside from staying alive. "But that's everything," my father wrote to me when I told him that in a letter. I started to take my mind off things. At dead of night in the mess hut, Pride and Prejudice, an English to Polish dictionary and a candle. I could have burnt the place down, but I had to do it. I needed words, lots of words to think about while I was going about the rest of the day. And I didn't want anything affected. I wanted nothing to do with those romance languages. I wanted clipped words, full of common sense. Thoughts to wear beneath my thoughts. Allow, express, oath, vow, dismay, matter, splash, mollify. I liked those words. I liked saying them. I still do. 8. I helped to load cannons. People are not good at war. Can I really say that when all I know is that I and those around me were not good at war? Don't say our hearts weren't in it. They were. But we got sick, some of us to death. Spanish flu and the rot of trench foot, and there were such smells they made us sick to our stomachs. A few of our men dropped cannonballs and broke their legs, that sort of thing. And then there was my cousin Karl. The first time he successfully shot a man, he didn't see a way to stop shooting. He knew he had to do more and with greater speed than the first kill. He couldn't aim steadily at anyone else, so he turned his rifle on himself and missed each time he did it, as if he was playing some sort of horrible trick on himself, the worst kind of bluff. He told me all about it. "Calm down, Karl," I told him. "You must keep your head." 9. Wake up, Mary. 10. I had a great uncle. He was rich, and we shared a Christian name. He liked me. I made him laugh without even trying. I said naive things that I really believed in. Things about life and money. He almost killed himself laughing at me. He liked to slap me on the back and tell me I looked like a peasant. When he died, he left me a lot of money. I liked him then. Before that, I must say I had often daydreamed about punching him in the throat. His neck was very fat. He owned factories, and I used to think that people like him were the source of all that was evil in the land. 11. Wake up, wake up. 12. When I was in Galicia, I tried not to think of my fiancée. I didn't write to her much, and in her own way she reproached me for that. She had every right to, so I won't dwell on the maddening indirect ways in which she reproached me. Anyhow, I lost her. When I came back, she looked through me and seemed displeased. I might have been the ghost of Banquo for all the pleasure she took in my company. She's happy now. She married my cousin, a good boy, who is tender with her. Yes, Karl. I believe I mentioned him in 8. Round and round, blissfully, Mary rolled in the words, propped her head up on some and her heels on others. She liked this man. 13. When I saw you for the first time, I thought you had a secret life. You had your hair up out of the way, and you were wearing your reading spectacles, and your dress was buttoned up all the way to your chin. Still, I noticed, if you will excuse my noticing, the fullness of your lips, and the way they parted every now and then, as if responding to changes in the breeze. And fleetingly, so fleetingly that it's possible you weren't aware you were doing it, you moved your hand from your cheek to your neck, to the center of your chest. You held your own waist and smoothed your skirt over your hips. Yes, you looked as if you had a secret.
or you were a secret in yourself. I had seen better lodgings further out, better lodgings for a bachelor, that is, a set of rooms I would have had all to myself, and I could have cycled to work and back. But I rented this house because of the lady who lived in the attic, to see if I could catch her out. 14. I took a lot of my inheritance money and I told everyone that I would be a lawyer, and I came here to study. When I got here, I was restless and nothing interested me. At the end of every evening, I got very drunk and vowed to give up my studies, and every morning I was back at the books. I am just trying to show you that my nature is not a consistent one. Sometimes I do what I say I'm going to do, but more often I don't. It's a failing, the least of my failings, and the only one I feel up to admitting at the moment. The rest will emerge if you choose to see it. I don't know if I'm the kind of man that is acceptable to you. I have heard that your father was a priest. 15. Shall I tell you how many times I came up these steps while you were typing, vowing that today would be the day that I asked you to the pictures, and I'd buy you a pound of violet creams, 2 pounds of them, whatever you wanted? But then I'd hear you at your typewriter, and I'd go away again. I decided that since I could not approach you, I would make you jealous. I asked my sister, Elisabetta, if it would work, and she said no. She also said you sounded too old for me. My mother and sisters are all very concerned about who I will marry. I am an only son. 16. This Mr. Fox, is he better looking than me?
Cold blew onto Mary Fox's blood, as if she had no skin at all.
17. My hand is getting tired. That must be why I slipped up just now. 18. You're sleeping yourself, Mary. Good thing you woke up before our little picnic on Murder Hill. A blue-eyed poet with some stories, a good line in wry humility, and some English as a second language bullshit. Is that all it takes to turn you fickle these days? Never mind. We'll pretend it didn't happen. 100 years hence, or 100 washes, whichever comes first, these words will be gone. The game was still on.
Fitch's Bird. Miss Fox referred to herself as a florist, but really she was a florist's assistant. She swept plant debris off the shop floor, and she wrapped flowers for the customers, and did everything else that the shop owner, Mrs. Nash, didn't feel like doing. Miss Fox wasn't allowed to cut and arrange the flowers used in the window display, nor was she allowed to advise people on the perfect floral gift. Miss Fox knew much more about flowers than Mrs. Nash, but all she could do was listen while Mrs. Nash told the anxious relatives of springtime invalids to send pink azaleas. Evidently, Mrs. Nash was not aware that in the language of flowers, azaleas meant take care of yourself for me. A touching thought, but by giving a sick person a bunch of azaleas, you were telling them that they were on their own. Mrs. Nash's agenda was simply to shift stock. In summer, Mrs. Nash prescribed marigolds left, right and centre for birthdays, apologies and romantic overtures, even though those flowers were better as a special comfort to the heartsick. But Miss Fox kept all that to herself for fear of losing her job. As it was, Mrs. Nash snapped at her and called her slow and asked her if she was an idiot 19 times a day. Miss Fox liked to be near the flowers, especially in winter, when it was easy to forget that there had ever been such a thing as a flower. Flowers and thoughts of flowers were Miss Fox's main occupation. She didn't especially care for motion pictures, she found them too noisy. She would have liked to have had friends to lend books to and borrow pie dishes from. But it was difficult for Miss Fox to reach that stage with anyone. She spoke so quietly that people couldn't understand what she was saying and quickly lost patience. When she paid for things in shops, the change was invariably placed on the counter instead of in her hand.
Miss Fox occasionally wondered whether she had spent her life approaching invisibility and had finally arrived at it. She encouraged herself to see her very small presence in the world as a good thing, a power, something that a hero might possess. Miss Fox's other passion was fairy tales. She loved the transformations in them. Everybody was in disguise, or on their way to becoming something else, and all was overcome by order in the end. Love could not prevail if the order of the tale didn't wish it, and neither could hatred, nor grief, nor cunning. If you were the first of three siblings, then you were going to make a big mistake, and that was that. If you were the third sibling, you couldn't fail. Here is the truth about everything, Miss Fox would think, after a night with Madame d'Aulnoy or Madame de Villeneuve. Flowers and fairy tales were all very well, but they began to take their toll on her. Independently and in unison, they made insinuations, the flowers and the fairy tales. When Mrs. Nash was being especially nasty, Miss Fox imagined herself surrounded by leafy branches that changed as her tears dripped onto them. Glossy green tips shrank and smoothed into skin. The branches gripped her firmly, like arms. One morning, Miss Fox gave in. It was high time she found herself a companion. But how? And where? She knew what kind of man she wanted. Someone passionate, someone who would understand her. But she didn't meet people. Every man who came into the flower shop was invariably attached, or had someone else in mind. Miss Fox went to bars, and was overlooked with a thoroughness that chilled her marrow. She had chosen seedy bars on purpose, bars where, she'd heard Mrs. Nash say, the men were voracious and anything went. And it was true. Even cross-eyed girls who laughed like hyenas were bought drinks. Anything went but Miss Fox. She wasn't bad-looking. It was just that it took a great deal of effort to be able to actually see her, especially in noisy, crowded places. Miss Fox tried libraries, but talking wasn't allowed. Miss Fox tried bookshops, but was frightened off every time she saw the titles of the books the interesting-looking men happened to be holding. Such weighty and joyless words, Fear and Trembling, Anatomy of Melancholy, The Nicomachean Ethics, and the like. One afternoon, Mrs. Nash barked at her. You've been late back from lunch, 5 days running now. Explain yourself, and don't fob me off with any more lies, or you'll be out of work. Miss Fox explained that she had been trying different things. What does that mean? Spit it out. I've been looking in the bookshops for a gentleman friend, poor Miss Fox stammered. Mrs. Nash threw her head back and laughed for 10 minutes without stopping. Then she said, You'd better advertise. And that is what Miss Fox did, in a national newspaper, no less. Fairy tale princess seeks fairy tale prince. Sarcastic and or ironic replies will be ignored. If the advertisement sounded as if Miss Fox was fed up, that's because she was. As a result of her advertisement, Miss Fox received 17 moderately interesting propositions, 15 pages of lunatic verse from 15 different lunatics, 12 sarcastic and or ironic replies, 6 of each, and a single foxglove wrapped in clear cellophane. The foxglove was accompanied by a card that read, Fitcher. The name was printed above an address not too far from where Miss Fox lived. Miss Fox held the flower and walked all around her bedroom in quick circles. Her steps sped up so that she was almost running. She felt her heart beating in her fingertips. She knew the foxglove's meaning in the language of flowers, beauty and danger, poison and antidote. The digitalis made the heart contract. If your heart was too slow, then it worked to make you well. If your heart was sound, the digitalis killed. This Fitcher, whoever he was, understood the beautiful risk of the fairy tale. She wrote to Fitcher at once, and 3 days later he met her at a coffee shop after work. Fitcher bemused Miss Fox. He looked at her.
He looked at her eyes, her ears, her teeth, her neck, her breasts. And he was a quiet man, but not in the way that she was quiet. His quiet was of the measured kind, entered into to conceal his thoughts. He stepped noiselessly upon the floor. She dreaded that at first.
"Is Fitcher your only name?" she asked him.
He answered, "I have no other." They spoke of fairy tales, and found their tastes were exactly matched. Encouraged, she met him again and again. At their fourth meeting, as they walked between glass cases at the British Museum, Fitcher threaded Miss Fox's fingers through his own. She froze. She did not find it easy to be touched by Fitcher. She found that her hand was warming his, and that though his hand was strong, it moved gently with hers. At their sixth meeting, Fitcher brought Miss Fox a nightingale in a gold-painted cage. He set the cage down on the shop counter and draped a black cloth over it. And the bird sang out its hope, the silly little romantic calling out for a mate, not caring if this nightfall was a trick. Mrs. Nash approved of Fitcher. "A proper Romeo, that one," she said. "He doesn't talk much, though," Miss Fox confided. "It worries me." "It's better that way," Mrs. Nash returned. "Pay attention to what he does, not what he says. That's the rule." And to this she added various other adages, such as, "It's in his kiss," etc. By their seventh meeting, Miss Fox had grown so sure of Fitcher that she felt ready for the next step. She invited him to her flat, where she cooked him dinner, and they drank wine by candlelight. Fitcher seemed appreciative, but as usual, said little. At last they were sitting on the sofa together. She fed him bites of lemon tart. Fitcher looked as if he was enjoying both the food and the attention. Once that was over with, Miss Fox reached behind the sofa and produced an antique sword that had been in her family for many years. It was half her height and heavy, but shiny and sharp, as she had recently had it oiled and sharpened. She laid the sword across their laps. "Take this sword," Miss Fox said solemnly, "and cut off my head." Fitcher and Miss Fox both fell to thinking of their favourite fairy tale, The White Cat, and the enchanted princess, pleading with her love to strike the blow that would release her from her animal form. "Are you sure?" Fitcher asked. From Miss Fox's bedroom, the nightingale sang in its cage. Miss Fox sighed. "Don't you believe?" "Oh, I do," said Fitcher. "I do." And without further argument, he unsheathed the sword and cleaved Miss Fox's head from her neck. He knew what was supposed to happen. He knew that this awkward, whispering creature before him should now transform into a princess, dazzlingly beautiful, free and made wise by her hardship. That is not what happened. I walked into my study, I don't know where from. Where had I just come from? What had I been doing? My step, at least, was sprightly. Maybe I'd just come from a book launch, or an award ceremony, or a meeting with an effusive film executive. I searched my pockets for clues, but my pockets were empty. Well, wherever I had been, Mary Fox had been there, too. Was I certain about that, or was I guessing? I whipped open the study door and regarded the hallway with a measure of suspicion. Everything was in order. I turned back to my study and registered the condition it was in. Books and crumpled paper and broken records were scattered around me as if they had rained from the sky. The windows stood wide open and a cold wind flowed in and made the torn pages of my books whisper. One of my shelves had fallen or been pushed down, and I had to walk across the back of it to get to my desk, which was soaked in ink. Thorough. The rampage had been thorough. I whistled, and then I closed the windows. The sound must have alerted Daphne, because she came and knocked on the door, which wasn't closed, so why knock? "Come in," I said.
I picked up half of a coffee mug and half of a phonograph record and idly held them together.
A domestic chimera.
Daphne came in, with her arms full of books and her eyes blazing like two poisoned moons.
How'd you like the mess, St. John?
It would have been better if she'd screamed. The question was in monotone and was accompanied by a hardback German edition of my first book, Stinging the Bees. More followed, books and flat statements, all aimed at my head. I was stunned and defended myself as best I could with my arms, but there was nowhere to hide. Daphne said she hadn't finished yet. She said she ought to burn the house down, and she just might do it while I was sleeping. She said I was a dead man walking. She said she was going to Reno. She said she should never, never have married a tarnished individual like me. Finally, at the top of her voice, she said, "Who is she, this woman you're humiliating me with?" She ran out of books and stood there, crying, her hands fluttering over her face. I'd fallen into a crouch to weather the storm, and I waited a second before I straightened up. My ear was bleeding a little, and when she saw that, she sobbed even harder. We looked at the crack she'd made in one of the windows. The Japanese edition of the butcher's boots is no slim tome.
Who is she?
Who is who? Daphne turned on her heel and made for the door. Where are you going?
To Reno! You better not contest the papers either!
I crossed the room and caught her hand, which seemed like the coldest and most fragile little thing in the world just then. I held her hand, patted it. She looked away and just let me hold it, as if it was of no use to her anymore. My wife was pretty, I noticed. Sort of elfin, but vulnerable-looking with it. All these wispy curls surrounding a heart-shaped face.
"Don't go to Reno," I said.
She looked at me out of the corner of her eye.
"That's it. That's your best shot at making me stay. Don't go to Reno."
I hadn't finished, Dee. I also wanted to tell you that you're paranoid.
I don't even know what you're talking about. All I've been doing is trying to win us some bread.
I raised her hand and kissed her wrist. She likes that. Give me a week or two, and we'll go someplace nice. Just you and me.
She was melting. She made a face.
Of course, just you and me. Who else would go with us, dummy?
Quite clearly, she had no solid evidence. It was interesting to know that I'd married someone who could cause this much destruction on a hunch. It made me like her more.
"Dee," I pulled her into my arms. She buried her face in my sweater and reached up with her handkerchief, pressing it against my ear.
"Greta says I shouldn't listen to a word you say. You're a liar."
I took custody of the handkerchief. It was awkward, her holding it, and she was applying more pressure than was necessary. "Greta lies more than me."
"How would you know that?"
"I don't, but I gotta defend myself."
"You're the liar. If you hadn't been up to anything, you'd be furious that I wrecked your study. You'd have thrown a hot iron at my head or something."
"Is there a hot iron to hand?"
She sniffled. "Yes, I was pressing my divorce dress." Daphne had bought a divorce dress with my money. Even more interesting. I'd had her down as a starry-eyed idealist who didn't notice my flaws. I'd have to keep an eye on her.
"Your heart is jerking," she mumbled.
"Oh, so you can hear that," I said into her hair. "It's saying, Daphne, Daphne."
How embarrassing.
"Don't tell anyone you heard."
"She keeps calling," Daphne said, "and hanging up. While you've been God knows where..."
"Who keeps calling and hanging up?"
"That girl you got on the side. Now don't deny it, St. John. I just know."
"You just know?"
"Yes."
She looked up at me so piercingly that my first instinct was to look away, but that would have been a mistake.
"But I don't want to leave you. Not really. So just drop her and we'll forget about it."
"Daphne, there is no girl on the side."
"Say whatever you want, just drop her, please."
"I can't," I said. She's in my head. I saw her expression and I talked fast. What I mean is she's not real, honey. She's only an idea. I made her up.
What?
I know this sounds unlikely, but you gotta believe me. If you don't, I've got nothing else to tell you.
Keep talking,